10, 9.
We choose to go to the moon.
Ignition sequence start.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
3.
Not because they are easy.
2.
But because they are hard.
1, 0.
KFI presents.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Cool Space News. With your host, Rod Pyle.
Hello and welcome to another Waiting Out the Pandemic Together episode of Cool Space News. I'm your host, Rod Pyle, and I'm what they call in Hollywood a multi-hyphenate. No, that's not a misdemeanor or something that will get... you thrown out of the PTA. It simply means I do a lot of different stuff for a living. I've been by turns a TV commercial producer, educational filmmaker, back when we actually used film, a documentary producer, a visual effects technician, and then finally book author and magazine editor. So as you can see, I had a lot of trouble figuring out what I wanted to be when I grew up, and sometimes still do. But that's half the fun of the journey. These days, I write space books for a living and edit Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. If you love space, check out the NSS's website at space.nss.org. It's the largest and oldest pro-space advocacy group around, and there are many member benefits to be had for a measly $50 per year. In my humble opinion, it's worth it just for our fine print magazine, but as you might imagine, I'm a bit biased. But it's true. This week, we're in for a real treat. I've tracked down author and space visionary Frank White, who wrote The Overview Effect in the 1980s and coined the theory by the same name. It refers to the transformative effect of viewing the Earth from space, especially from beyond low Earth orbit. But I know I won't do justice to his decades-long body of work, so I'll let Frank tell this story. But first... In place of cool space headlines this week, I'd like to talk a bit about COVID. About a decade ago, I wrote a show pilot for Discovery TV about pandemics, and it scared the ever-living crap out of me. I've stayed in touch with some of the doctors and epidemiologists I work with since then, and began discussing the COVID pandemic with a number of them before the end of January. They were scared to death and nailed exactly what this would become, an unchecked wildfire, especially in the United States. I'm currently living aboard a 42-foot boat, technically a yacht, since anything over 35 feet long is supposedly a yacht, but lest you get the wrong idea, it's like living in a moving floating RV. This is where I've ended up isolating for the duration of this pandemic. Now down here in the South San Diego Bay Area in Southern California, specifically at the marina, I'm surrounded by COVID deniers. Very few people out here wear masks, and when they do, they are usually poorly fitted bandanas that rest below their noses. Now, come on. Few people are really that stupid as to not have a clue how respiration works. That's just sloppy, arrogant behavior, in my opinion. And clearly from people who simply cannot be inconvenienced by reality. And it's not just the young people so often cited in the media. This includes plenty of older folks my age and above who simply cannot be bothered to protect themselves or those around them. Why do I bring this up this week? Simply because of this, I recently watched my 90-year-old mother struggle for her life due to COVID. Her residential facility had successfully kept the pandemic at bay for a full 6 months through the mighty efforts of a very dedicated staff. But there was one slip, one sickened employee or vendor who got inside, and within a week, half the residents and some of the workers were infected. One of those was my mother. The grace of it is that she did not suffer for long, and she slipped away on a Wednesday. The staff and hospice workers, all laboring at significant risk to themselves and their families, were miracle workers. I can't say enough good things about them. But my sister and I were able to spend some time with Mom shortly before the end. We were dressed up in full protective gear because we're smart. And this is a disease you do not want. I've seen a number of people die in my lifetime, but nothing could compare to the horror of COVID. Choking, gurgling, struggling to take the shallowest breath. She was not aware of what was happening, fortunately. Because of good hospice care and the miracle of morphine. But it's a terrifying way to go, and you don't want this to happen to you or anyone you know. So please wear your damn mask, keep some damn social distancing, and protect yourself and others like my mother from the scourge. It's not going away anytime soon, so wear a mask. End of rant. So back to today's main act. Frank White might accurately be called a polymath. He's good at a lot of things, but known primarily for his work on the Overview Effect. Frank and I are both boomers, and we were both interested in spaceflight and science as young men, and we're both discouraged by the evils of higher mathematics from going into the technical side, which was about all that was available in those days if you wanted to be part of the great spaceflight adventure. We went about this in different ways, but we both wanted to be communicators of this great story. Frank is one of those annoyingly overachieving types, like many of the astronauts he's interviewed over the years, having attended both Harvard and Oxford and earning top marks at both institutions. Go Frank. He's written a number of deeply philosophical books, starting with The Overview Effect in 1987. It's a testament to the impact of this book that is still available in print. He's interviewed many dozens of astronauts on their experiences in space. And believe me, getting philosophical reflections out of astronauts, engineers, and test pilots often takes a lot of skill, which Frank heads in spades. He currently has a number of videos of these meetings done in coordination with NASA posted on his website, frankwhiteauthor.com, so take a look. Now, without further ado, I introduce you to Frank White and part one of this remarkable interview. Enjoy. Hello, Frank. Thanks for joining us today. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Rod, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So I think we'll start. I've already talked a little bit with our listeners about just the barest thumbnail of The Overview Effect. So I'd like to go right back to you. What got you interested in spaceflight in the first place? We grew up kind of during the same era, so I suspect we have a similar background that way. But what got you wound up about this?
Yeah, well, I have two answers to that, and I will give you both. My first cousin, with whom I grew up down in Mississippi, tells me that I started talking about leaving planet Earth at the age of five. And she cites a moment we were sitting in a parking lot of a grocery store waiting for our mothers to come out. And I said to her, "Anne, I hope you realize that we are going to have to leave this planet and go live on other planets. Planets do not last forever, you know." So I honestly, Rod, do not remember that.
It's a great story, though.
It's a great story. What I do remember is at the age of 10, we lived in Germany. My dad was in the army. My mother came home one day and said, "Hey, I thought you might like this book." And she gave me a book about astronomy called Stars. It's still printed today. That was maybe 1954. And I can just say it really blew my mind. I thought, oh man, there's this entire universe out there. How interesting. It's so interesting. So I became immediately interested in astronomy. That led, of course, to an interest in spaceflight, becoming an astronaut, all of those things. And of course, science fiction. I started reading the greats, Isaac Asimov and people like that. And I just was fascinated with the whole idea of space exploration. And that was the beginning. Of course, we can talk about where it went from there, if you like.
Of course.
Well, you know, to carry the story forward a little bit, the question was, and the dilemma for me was, how do I get into space exploration without being an engineer? I wrote to Verna von Braun, who was over in Alabama, and said, how do I get involved in this whole enterprise?
Well, so you went right to the top. That's respectable.
Guess what? He wrote back.
Yeah.
His response wasn't too encouraging for me. He said, math and science, and engineering. And essentially, he said, I needed to get good at things I wasn't very good at. Mm. That was probably around the time of Sputnik. So I would have been 13 or 14 at that point. And that was a bit of a setback. But I continued thinking how to get into space. And my first idea was to go to the Air Force Academy. And in fact, I got into the Air Force Academy, but I also got into Harvard. And I looked at the curriculum of the Air Force Academy, and I guess Wernher von Braun wrote it. It was all engineering, math, and science. Not all, but mostly. And I looked at the Harvard requirements. There was no math requirement and a very minimal science requirement. I thought, well, I better play to my strengths. So I went to Harvard, became a social scientist, went to Oxford, continued that work. But there was always this thing of how do I get back to my passion? And of course, I saw Apollo 8 and Apollo 11 while I was in England. And I just had this looming question of how to get into the space field without being an engineer or a technology person or a scientist. And as you well know, you can apply to be a NASA astronaut, but if you don't have a technical degree, you're not going to get in. You're not going to make it.
Right. So, they're not big on Renaissance people like us.
No. I mean, they keep talking about science, and I keep saying, social science? Social science is a science. Anyway, I discovered Gerard K. O'Neill and Space Studies Institute. That was the big breakthrough. And I was so excited because SSI welcomed people like me, people like you. They were thinking not about just missions, but about space settlements, about habitats, people living in these fantastic settlements that Gerard O'Neill was coming up with. And the first paper I ever wrote about space exploration was delivered at an SSI conference in the early 80s. And so that's where I found my home. And that also led to the idea of the overview effect.
So I'm glad you arrived there because, of course, that's my next question. How did that come about, and what was your earliest definition of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know that I'm very interested in systems theory, and my first paper was called Space Settlements as Human Systems. So my first angle into the whole area was systems thinking. But I was really obsessing about what would life in such a settlement be like? What would it be like to live in such a place? And I was flying cross country to do some consulting, had nothing to do with space exploration, but I fell into sort of an altered state, I guess, looking out the window for many hours. And I think I had a mild experience of what we now call the overview effect, because I realized there were no borders or boundaries between the states. And I realized that the system was whole. It was a whole system. So that went back to systems thinking. And I had this phrase come into my mind that anyone living in a space settlement would always have an overview. And then I had the idea of the overview effect. And the earliest definition, I think, was probably that it was a change of awareness that in the earliest phases of working on it, I thought it would be a change of awareness that space settlers would have. But actually, it wasn't so much a change as just something they would take for granted. Like, we take it for granted the moon is in the sky. We're not shocked to see the moon. We'd be shocked if it weren't there. But of course, again, coming from a social science background, there were no permanent space communities at the time. So I decided to interview astronauts as proxies for these future space settlers. And over time, the definition changed to a shift in awareness that astronauts experience, because what I thought would be kind of ordinary and routine, it turned out when I started interviewing astronauts, this experience was not ordinary and routine. It was extraordinary. This is an important part of the history because there are some misconceptions. Some people have said, so you started interviewing astronauts and you came up with the idea of the overview effect, right? No, that isn't what happened. I had the idea, the hypothesis, and then I set out to document whether the hypothesis was correct or not. And I've told this story before, Rod, but it's kind of funny. As soon as I could after that flight, I called NASA and I said, I have to interview the entire astronaut corps because I needed a large sample size to prove my point. And the guy at the other end kind of chuckled and said, well, I don't think we can do that because the astronauts are kind of busy, but if you'll come to Houston, I'll set up an interview with two astronauts. That was kind of disappointing because, I mean, that's not going to prove anything. But of course, I didn't say that. And then as an aside, he said, why don't you interview former astronauts?
Ah.
Oh. And he said, we don't control them. And it had never occurred to me that they didn't control everybody, whether they were active or retired. So then that really led to the breakthrough where I started talking to colleagues and I said, do you know any astronauts that I could interview? And Brian O'Leary, you may know him or know of him, was a very active member of Space Studies Institute. He was actually an Apollo astronaut who resigned before he flew. Yeah. But, he introduced me to Joe Allen, and Joe was the first astronaut that agreed to be interviewed, at least the first former astronaut. NASA did come through, and I went to Houston, and I interviewed Jeff Hoffman and Don Lynn, and those were great interviews. They really were. They are part of the group of interviews that are still part of the book.
So you're coming to these guys as a relative newcomer to their cadre. You're not somebody they're really familiar with at this point, right?
Right.
So did you first explain your hypothesis and then ask them to discuss their experiences, or did you just set up an interview and let them go freely to see if it would fit? How did you approach that?
Yeah, you know, I tended to share with them what I was trying to get at. Actually, the interview with Joe Allen was a bit of a off-the-wall interview because I was at work, and I worked in a public relations agency, and I think we had one of those kind of loudspeakers that you have, or I don't know quite how it was, but whoever answered the phone contacted me and said, there's somebody named Joe Allen on the line for
some guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just, I went to my desk, grabbed something to write on, and I don't even remember what I first asked him. But, you know, I kind of got at the basic idea. And with Jeff Hoffman and Don Lynn, they were so easy to work with. Jeff is still someone I'm in touch with, and I think I could say is a friend. And he is a very thoughtful person in talking about what he experienced. And he and I had a great kind of exploration of the experience. And one of the things he said that was interesting was that he felt like the technological impact of space exploration was much greater, perhaps, than the philosophical impact. And he talked about satellites and global communication. And I ended up calling that the technological overview effect, because it really is. I mean, the astronaut sees this unity and oneness of our planet, and the technology makes it real. Don Lynn was interesting for many, many reasons. First of all, he was the first astronaut who told me that seeing the Earth from orbit brought tears to his eyes. That was interesting. I've since heard a couple of more astronauts say exactly the same thing. But he also was very clear that he was disturbed by reports that spaceflight was a religious experience. Don is a Mormon. He is religious. And he said, I interviewed just about everybody in the Apollo program. And he said, I think people who were too busy to be religious before they went were too busy to be religious while they were there and after they came back. But he did talk about his own religious views and how it colored what he saw. But whenever people ask me, is the overview effect a religious or spiritual experience? I talk a lot about definitions, but I also refer them to Don. However, at the same time, he gave a very poetic description of what I call the overview effect, which is this idea that you don't see the borders and boundaries over which we fight wars. We're all stuck on this beautiful planet in an incredibly hostile space, and we're all in the same boat. And it's this sense that has come out lately in the COVID crisis that we're all in this together as human beings, and actually all life on Earth. We're all in this together. We're interconnected. And we don't know anywhere else in the solar system that is as friendly to living things as the Earth. So there's this whole sense that we really have no choice but to take good care of our planet. Do a better job of taking care of it, I should say.
Right. Now, a question here, as far as your astronaut interviews go, did you ever have, and this can be a kind of off the record answer if you don't want to identify the person, but I remember watching, for instance, some people try and interview John Young about the space shuttle before it flew. And, you know, they were saying, well, isn't this machine dangerous? You know, it's never been tested without human beings. What happens if there's an emergency? And John Young, being a man of few words, just kind of flashed that smile of his that would kind of come and go like a flashbulb and said, indicating in his imagination, the abort handle, said, you just pulled a little handle. And I thought it was kind of an interviewer's nightmare. You know, if you're doing an in-depth academic interview, it's one thing, but this was on camera for news and you could see them really sweating, trying to get more out of him. Did you have many of those, or did you find that most people were pretty willing to open up and talk about this?
Most of the astronauts I've interviewed, in fact, I'd say almost all of them, feel a responsibility to share their experience. First of all, I think there's a realization that we paid for it. They didn't get to go, especially I'm talking about NASA. They didn't get to go for their own pleasure, nor did they pay for it. And so I've had many of them talk about the feeling that they have an obligation to share it. And then, especially for those who were affected in the way Don Lynn was, there's a sense that it's a very important message to share. And they really want people to understand what they saw. because of its relevant to its relevance to life on Earth. And it's this realization, first of all, that we're on this spaceship. We are the crew. There isn't any other crew. And certainly, most astronauts are interested in going to the moon or going to Mars. But they also realize, as Jeff Bezos would say, this is the best planet in the solar system. And, you know, they also, they do have this other feeling that you can't see these borders over which we fight wars. And the whole idea of fighting wars just seems wrong and narrow. And so there's an environmental reaction, but there's also humanitarian and personal reaction to the way humanity behaves on the surface. And there seems to be a feeling among the people I've interviewed that if only more people could have the experience, life on Earth would get better. It would, people would cooperate more, be more willing to work together. And, you know, they compare it to what it's like to be on the International Space Station, where you have people from different countries, different backgrounds. They have to work together. They have no choice. And they're well aware of that. And it doesn't mean that they always get along and sing Kumbaya every evening, but they know that they have to cooperate, and they want people on Earth to understand the same thing.
So have you had a chance to have second round discussions with some of these people a few years later to see how they're, how reflecting on their experience over a few years might have changed their outlook on this topic?
That's a really good question. And I was talking with Nicole Stott about it. As you probably know, she is the artistic astronaut, I think is her handle. She was an artist before she went, but it was more of a hobby. And she, I believe, is the first person to paint a picture in orbit. But since coming back, she's gotten very deeply involved in space art and art and space together, how they can make a difference in life. And we were talking about how I really need to do that. It would really be a good idea. The only person who comes to mind is Charlie Walker. Charlie Walker flew three times in the mid-1980s for McDonnell Douglas. He was a payload specialist.
Right.
I did interview Charlie recently for the fourth edition of my book. And I'm going to have to go back over it to give you a very detailed answer of the changes. But he did say he did not think of his experience as spiritual at the time, but over the years, he has felt more and more that it was spiritual. And again, I would have to look back at the interview to tell you more. But that's a change, I think, that is significant. And I think one thing we have to realize, Rod, in June of last year, I went to Johnson Space Center and I interviewed three astronauts while they were on the International Space Station. That's the only interview I've ever done with people in the middle of the experience.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was exciting. And they were really right on topic. They were very interested in sharing. And, you know, I could see them. They were floating up and down and passing the mic back and forth. You know how they do those interviews.
Right.
But they were just so clear in what they were talking about. You have to realize, though, all of my other interviews are retrospective.
Right.
So it's kind of like you ask me, when did you first know you're interested in space exploration? And I tell you about that encounter with my mother. Again, I'm remembering something that happened many, many years ago. And so all of my interviews except that one interview are retrospective. I don't know what that means, but what I think it means, it's somewhat like an overview effect of time. I believe as you move further and further away from an experience, you get more and more of an overview of it, that you see it. I'm not sure you see it more accurately, but you do see it differently. Mm-hmm. When I interviewed Alan Bean, he said something really interesting. He said, you know, when we were out there, when I was on the moon, I had this job to do. I was supposed to set up this instrument and I was supposed to get it right. And that's what I was thinking about. I wasn't pondering, oh, I'm on the moon. I'm kind of paraphrasing him now.
Yeah.
Not accurate. But what he was pointing out was the astronauts, and this is especially true in the early days, really had a job to do, and they were very focused on that. And I think even today, most of the reason people go to the International Space Station is to do a job. Now, NASA has realized, and I believe the Russians have realized too, on the ISS, giving people time off and not trying to force them to work all the time and letting them go to the cupola and look out and enjoy earth gazing is good for their psychological health. But many of the astronauts have pointed out to me the difference between the ISS and a shuttle launch. And on a shuttle mission, your time is very, very precious. Mm-hmm. People did take the time to look out. But Don Lynn told me, I think it wasn't until after he'd been on orbit 2 or 3 days that he even looked out and saw the Earth. That's how busy he was. And I think it was Tracy Dyson told me on her shuttle flight, at the very end, the shuttle commander brought everybody together and they dimmed the lights. Mm. And he said, I don't want you to do anything for the next half hour, but I want you to look out and see this extraordinary sight.
That's remarkable.
But he had to do that because people were so busy.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's not really extraordinary. I think a lot of the astronauts have compared the experience to going to the Grand Canyon and how seeing a picture of the Grand Canyon doesn't do it justice. I went to the Grand Canyon a few years ago, and there were a couple of aspects of the trip. One was we weren't there very long. And the other is that over time, as I think back on it, my understanding of it changes. So it's a long way of answering your question. And what I hope to do is exactly what you're talking about, which is go back to some of the people I've interviewed and see how the memory alters over time.
Thanks for joining us again on Cool Space News. Part 2 of this interview will be posted shortly. If you're intrigued by spaceflight topics, be sure to check out both Frank's website and my own at pilebooks.com. Our many books are all available through Amazon and at other fine booksellers around the globe. Until next time, always remember, be humble for your native Earth, be noble for your native stars. See you next time.